Welcome. We come back to The Life Divine. We're in Chapter 20, The Philosophy of Rebirth. And he is pursuing the great mystery behind birth. How is it that a supreme being consents to conceal itself, its immaculate reality, its powerful consciousness, its full experience of itself in what seems to be its opposite? Why would the spirit take birth in what seems to be the inconscient, in what seems to be nescience, and take birth and take birth again? This is a philosophy of rebirth that he asserts here. But how is it that we get to rebirth? Who is it? What is it that could be reborn? What kind of cosmology would support this? So he begins to look at the nature of the universe, first from the material perspective, in which then the inning of the individual is brief. Somewhere in the process of time, an individual appears and disappears. Nothing left, gone. So there's no sense of rebirth. If materialism is all sufficient as an explanation of the cosmos. There is a vitalistic view of the cosmos as well, and the universe is real therein, but even if there are waves of life that throw up living forms, they need not be immortal. They need not come back again and again through the process of birth. They're gone with a passing wave. If we turn away from this and look instead at the mind's perspective of what might be an eternal being, then the philosopher of Advaita Vedanta will look and say that there is only that one. It is a conscious existent, but it never accepts birth. It never accepts the changeful nature of time, the phenomenal play. All of that is illusory. This one is immaculate, ever the same, unchanging. So how can there be a rebirth when there could never be a real birth? And if we look at the Buddhist solution, there is no real person who exists. What seems to configure itself in birth after birth is simply the continuing chain of a karmic energy which repopulates again and again some form or the other until that energy is exhausted. There again is no entity taking birth. Sri Aurobindo has looked at all of these and found that each one of them, for various reasons, is inadequate as an explanation to the nature of the universe. We have seen that he concludes that this is a world built from Satchit Ananda, a conscious existent whose nature is delight. And when we go back to look at the Vedantic underpinnings to Indian spirituality, we find early on an assertion that indeed that immense spirit which is seen and recognized in Advaita Vedanta is purposefully engaged with universal production, indwells within the universe every being, every becoming, every energism that manifests, that the individual too is identical in essence with that Brahman who manifests as the universe. And we have many examples, of course, of this kind of display in the Upanishads. We can find it in the Brihadaranyaka, the oldest and greatest of the Upanishads. Obviously the Isha Upanishad, in the Mundaka Upanishad, later, of course, in the Bhagavad Gita. But what we see is essentially identical poises that this transcendent takes in the individual standing forth as the Atman, not merely the individual, but swelling to universal extent, and as Brahman, that thing which underlies all the processive manifestations of a moving cosmos. Essentially, Atman and Brahman are the same. Rebirth, punarjanman, to be born again. It is not reincarnation, but rebirth, which the Indian philosophy speaks about most eloquently. We don't see in the Rig Veda at all. It isn't a mention there. In the Rig Veda, there is existence after death, but no suggestion that one comes back from those fatherly heavens back into a form on earth. We don't begin to meet that concept until we get to the Shatapatha Brahmana. It begins to appear there and obviously has beautiful expressions in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, etc. And it goes on and on. And then we find in the later Upanishads, like the Shvetashvatara and the Mundaka and Katha, that there are particular philosophies attached to why would this being come back. And we will get to those in the line of Sri Aurobindo's argument. But all of this builds a context for where we are right now. So Sri Aurobindo has just laid down, when we closed a couple of weeks ago, that in fact, the older Upanishads definitely suggest that this reality, Brahman, is cognate not only with what appears in the universe, but with the soul that appears in the individual. And now he continues. The philosophy of rebirth. But this reality of the individual is quite temporal. It has no enduring foundation, not even a perpetual recurrence in time. Rebirth, though a very important actuality in this account of the universe, is not an inevitable consequence of the relation between individuality and the purpose of the manifestation. For the manifestation seems to have no purpose except the will of the eternal towards world creation, and it can end only by that will's withdrawal. This cosmic will could work itself out without any machinery of rebirth and the individual's desire maintaining it. For his desire can be only a spring of the machinery. It could not be the cause or the necessary condition of cosmic existence, since he is himself, in this view, a result of the creation and not in existence prior to the becoming. So in this view, the individual arises with the manifestation of the cosmos, even if it is cognate with the universal presence, it is not precedent to it. It is contingent upon it. He continues, the will to creation could then accomplish itself through a temporary assumption of individuality in each name and form, a single life of many impermanent individuals. There would be a self-shaping of the one consciousness in correspondence with the type of each created being. But it could very well begin in each individual body with the appearance of the physical form and end with its cessation. Individual would follow individual as wave follows wave, the sea remaining always the same. each formation of conscious being would surge up from the universal, roll for its allotted time, and then sink back into the silence. So we have a footnote here. Dr. Schweitzer, in his book on Indian thought, asserts that this was the real sense of the Upanishadic teachings, and rebirth was a later invention. But there are numerous important passages in almost all the Upanishads positively affirming rebirth. And in any case, the Upanishads admit the survival of the personality after death and its passage into other worlds, which is incompatible with this interpretation. If there is survival in other worlds, and also a final destiny of liberation into the Brahman for souls embodied here, rebirth imposes itself, and there is no reason to suppose that it was a later theory. The writer has evidently been moved by the associations of Western philosophy to read a merely pantheistic sense into the more subtle and complex thought of the ancient Vedanta. I think Sri Aurobindo is absolutely correct about this. Albert Schweitzer's book, by the way, was titled Indian Thought and Its Development. It was published in 1935 by Beacon Press in Boston. So Sri Aurobindo probably had only had it in his possession for a little while by the time he had the chance to read this appraisal that Schweitzer offers. Schweitzer is well known, of course, as an organist, a musician, a theologian, a philosopher to some extent, but he was out of his element when he came to understanding the subtleties and the complexities of Indian philosophy. He did see things in this pantheistic view. And the one thing that he could understand about Indian philosophy was its insistence, especially in Jainism, on ahimsa, on non-injury to other things. It was the one ethical code that he found worth noting in Indian philosophy. The rest of it, I think, slipped like sand through his fingers. We'll continue. The necessity for this purpose of an individualized consciousness persistently continuous, assuming name after name and form after form, and moving between different planes, backward and forward, is not apparent, and even as a possibility, does not strongly impose itself. Still less is there any room for an evolutionary progress inevitably pursued from form to higher form, such as must be supposed by a theory of rebirth that affirms the involution and evolution of the spirit in matter as the significant formula of our terrestrial existence. This is the backdrop. This really gets down to the bones of what we're considering here, because Sri Aurobindo has previously analyzed the metaphysical underpinnings of materialism and vitalism and these various other worldviews and found them all wanting, and presented to us this far more comprehensive theory, which he has originated, in which this unknowable reality, defined to our eyes as Satchit-Ananda, organized within its own being as a supramental gnosis, could, through intermediaries, mind, life, and matter, install itself in what appears to be its opposite as an inconscient, with this process of involution intended to proceed and incipiently introduce us to a re-emergence of hidden divinity through evolution, recovering in multifarious forms its original unity, and recapture delight. Recapture full consciousness, recapture truth of being. Here, in time and space, however restructured they may be through this transformative process, but this is the play of the cosmos. which Sri Aurobindo has asserted makes more sense than all the other views of the universe which we've considered, and we've looked at many. So if what we see is not in accord with that, then eventually he's going to set it aside as an inarguable thesis. It is conceivable that so the Eternal may have actually chosen to manifest, or rather to conceal himself in the body. He may have willed to become or to appear as an individual passing from birth to death and from death to new life in a cycle of persistent and recurrent human and animal existence. The one being personalized would pass through various forms of becoming at fancy or according to some law of the consequences of action, karma, till the close came by an enlightenment, a return to oneness, a withdrawal of the soul and identical from that particular individualization. But such a cycle would have no original or final determining truth which would give it any significance. There is nothing for which it would be necessary. It would be purely a play, a lila. But if it is at once admitted that the spirit has involved itself in the inconscience and is manifesting itself in the individual being by an evolutionary gradation, then the whole process assumes meaning and consistence. The progressive ascent of the individual becomes a keynote of this cosmic significance, and the rebirth of the soul and the body becomes a natural and unavoidable consequence of the truth of the becoming and its inherent law. Rebirth is an indispensable machinery for the working out of a spiritual evolution. It is the only possible effective condition, the obvious dynamic process of such a manifestation in the material universe. Our explanation of the evolution in matter is that the universe is a self-creative process of a supreme reality whose presence makes spirit the substance of things. All things are there as the spirit's powers and means and forms of manifestation. An infinite existence, an infinite consciousness, an infinite force and will, an infinite delight of being is the reality secret behind the appearances of the universe. Its divine supermind, or gnosis, has arranged the cosmic order, but arranged it indirectly through the three subordinate and limiting terms of which we are conscious here: mind, life, and matter. The material universe is the lowest stage of a downward plunge of the manifestation, an involution of the manifested being of this triune reality into an apparent nescience of itself, that which we now call the inconscient. But out of this nescience, the evolution of that manifested being into a recovered self-awareness was, from the very first, inevitable. So he's just described here the entirety, or the substance of that chapter on the sevenfold cord of being, all compressed into a couple of sentences. It was inevitable because that which is involved must evolve. For it is not only there as an existence, a force hidden in its apparent opposite, and every such force must in its inmost nature be moved to find itself, to realize itself, to release itself into play, but it is the reality of that which conceals it. It is the self which the nescience has lost and which, therefore, it must be the whole secret meaning, the constant drift of its action to seek for and recover. And nescience simply means not to know, to forget yourself completely. It is through the conscious individual being that this recovery is possible. It is in him that the evolving consciousness becomes organized and capable of awaking to its own reality. The immense importance of the individual being, which increases as he rises in the scale, is the most remarkable and significant fact of a universe which started without consciousness and without individuality in an undifferentiated nescience. Sri Aurobindo has stated this cosmological truth, where the individual is key to the disclosure of the hidden divinity in manifestation period, that it cannot occur without the individual, that we are utterly indispensable. By implication, no one being could possibly achieve this in the span of a limited human life. And so he's going to lead us to the conclusion that a stadia of lives, life after life after life, will be necessary for the soul manifesting in the individual to achieve this for the cosmos, to fulfill the hidden purpose of the divine in the universe. And if I may go farther, this grand vision linking individual to universe, both to the supreme as the purpose, has not been adumbrated in any other philosophy, has never been announced with such clarity. We find patches of this vision in the great Upanishads, in the Bhagavad Gita. Nothing brings it into the compass of what we can see in the same way that Sri Aurobindo has achieved in the life divine. This is the first time all of these things have been brought into harmonic unity in the whole history of human philosophy and religious thought. This importance, he writes, can only be justified if the self as individual is no less real than the self as cosmic being or spirit, and both are powers of the eternal. It is only so that can be explained the necessity for the growth of the individual and his discovery of himself as a condition for the discovery of the cosmic self and consciousness and of the supreme reality. If we adopt this solution, this is the first result, the reality of the persistent individual. But from that first consequence, the other result follows, that rebirth of some kind is no longer a possible machinery which may or may not be accepted. It becomes a necessity, an inevitable outcome of the root nature of our existence. For it is no longer sufficient to suppose an illusory or temporary individual created in each form by the play of consciousness. Individuality can no longer be conceived as an accompaniment of play of consciousness in figure of body which may or may not survive the form, may or may not prolong its false continuity of self from form to form, from life to life, but which certainly need not do it. In this world, what we seem at first to see is individual, replace an individual without any continuity, the form dissolving, the false or transient individuality dissolving with it, while the universal energy or some universal being alone remains forever. That might very well be the whole principle of cosmic manifestation. But if the individual is a persistent reality, an eternal portion or power of the eternal, if his growth of consciousness is the means by which the spirit in things discloses its being, the cosmos reveals itself as a conditioned manifestation of the play of the Eternal One in the being of Satchit-Ananda with the Eternal Many. Then, secure behind all the changings of our personality, upholding the stream of its mutations, there must be a true person, a real spiritual individual, a true Purusha. The one extended in universality exists in each being and affirms himself in this individuality of himself. In the individual, he discloses his total existence by oneness with all in the universality. In the individual, he discloses too his transcendence as the eternal in whom all the universal unity is founded. This trinity of self-manifestation, this prodigious lila of the manifold identity, this magic of Maya or protean miracle of the conscious truth of being of the infinite, is the luminous revelation which emerges by a slow evolution from the original in conscience. And along the way, he's collected into this view the Isha Upanishad, Bhagavad Gita, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. What a grand vision. Aren't you glad you're here in this world, in this magnificent cosmos? Now he's showing you why you are here. A delight. If there were no need of self-finding, but only an eternal enjoyment of this play of the being of Satchit-Ananda, and such an eternal enjoyment is the nature of certain supreme states of conscious existence, then evolution and rebirth need not have come into operation. But there has been an involution of this unity into the dividing mind, a plunge into self-oblivion by which the ever-present sense of the complete oneness is lost, and the play of separative difference, phenomenal because the real unity and difference remains unabridged behind, comes into the forefront as a dominant reality. This play of difference has found its utmost term of the sense of division by the precipitation of the dividing mind into a form of body in which it becomes conscious of itself as a separate ego. A dense and solid basis has been laid for this play of division in a world of separative forms of matter by an involution of the active self-conscience of Satchit-Ananda into a phenomenal nescience. This is the descent through Chit-Tapas into what seems to blacken and obliterate its own being. It is this foundation in nescience, unknowingness, that makes the division secure, because it imperatively opposes a return to the consciousness of unity. So we have to struggle back from this division towards unity, and it's constantly fighting against us, trying to annul and cancel out our every effort. But still, though effectively obstructive, it is phenomenal and terminable. So, it is episodic, and it has an end, because within it, above it, supporting it, is the all-conscient spirit. And the apparent nescience turns out to be only a concentration, an exclusive action of consciousness, tranced into self-forgetfulness by an abysmal plunge into the absorption of the formative and creative material process. So you can see a sort of telescoping occurring here with this vast white light of pure existence and delight through its own conscious force comes and conceals itself in this black material encasement, which is tiny by comparison with its infinity, even if it's universal in scope, still tiny by comparison with that. In a phenomenal universe so created, the separative form becomes the foundation and the starting point of all its life action. Therefore, the individual Purusha, in working out its cosmic relations with the One, has in this physical world to base himself upon the form, to assume a body. It is the body that he must make his own foundation and the starting point for his development of the life and mind and spirit in the physical existence. That assumption of body we call birth, and in it only can take place here the development of self and the play of relations between the individual and the universal and all other individuals. In it only can there be the growth by a progressive development of our conscious being towards a supreme recovery of unity with God and with all in God. All the sum of what we call life in the physical world is a progress of the soul and proceeds by birth into the body and has that for its fulcrum, its condition of action, and its condition of evolutionary persistence. So the body is indispensable. Entering through the portal of birth is the only way we can validate and redeem the universe and the whole cosmic enterprise, ultimately. Fulcrum, by the way, it's a word that just means prop in Latin. It's a fixed point, you know, on which a lever moves. So the body is that lever through which we achieve this transformation. We change what happens in the universe by holding tight to that point, by holding this body, by fixing our consciousness in this body. We use it as the fulcrum to change nature. Birth, then, is a necessity of the manifestation of the Purusha on the physical plane. But his birth, whether the human or any other, cannot be in this world order an isolated accident or a sudden excursion of a soul into physicality without any preparing past to it or any fulfilling hereafter. In other words, we can't just arrive as a blip, suddenly out of nowhere and be gone. In a world of involution and evolution, not of physical form only, but of conscious being through life and mind to spirit, such an isolated assumption of life in the human body could not be the rule of the individual soul's existence. It would be a quite meaningless and inconsequential arrangement, a freak for which the nature and system of things here have no place, a contrary violence which would break the rhythm of the spirit's self-manifestation. Because for us to come into this world through involution and insist on evolving out of it is a volitional statement. We have come here purposefully, not accidentally. We have not been cast here from some heaven above and we've landed willy-nilly here and there in some span of time, in some particular place, but we have intentionally dived into the very depths of the cosmos on purpose. We chose to come here. We did it. The intrusion of such a rule of individual soul life into an evolutionary spiritual progression would make it an effect without cause, and a cause without effect. It would be a fragmentary present without a past or a future. The life of the individual must have the same rhythm of significance, the same law of progression as the cosmic life. Its place in that rhythm cannot be a stray, purposeless intervention. It must be an abiding instrumentation of the cosmic purpose. Neither in such an order can we explain an isolated advent, a one birth of the soul in the human body, which would be its first and last experience of the kind, by a previous existence in other worlds, with a future before it in yet other fields of experience. For here, life upon earth, life in the physical universe, is not and cannot be a casual perch for the wanderings of the soul from world to world. It is a great and slow development needing, as we now know, incalculable spaces of time for its evolution. Human life is itself only a term in a graded series through which the secret spirit in the universe develops gradually his purpose and works it out finally through the enlarging and ascending individual soul consciousness in the body. This ascent can only take place by rebirth within the ascending order. An individual visit coming across it and progressing on some other line elsewhere could not fit into the system of this evolutionary existence. Nor is the human soul, the human individual, a free wanderer, capriciously or lightly hastening from field to field, according to its unfettered choice, or according to its free and spontaneously variable action and result of action. That is a radiant thought of pure spiritual liberty, which may have its truth in planes beyond or in an eventual release, but is not true at first of the earth life, of life in the physical universe. I would add as an aside, there is a closing section in the Taittiriya Upanishad where just such a description of the exultant, victorious, and liberated soul goes wandering off as he or she lists, going here, going there, coursing through all the worlds at will, enjoying as it goes. So Sri Aurobindo translated that, so, you know, has full knowledge that, yes, it is a possibility. It is not the main thing that we're doing here. Back to the here and now, back to our focus upon earth, says he. The human birth in this world is on its spiritual side a complex of two elements. A spiritual person and a soul of personality. The former is man's eternal being. The latter is his cosmic and mutable being. As the spiritual impersonal person, he is one in his nature and being with the freedom of Satchit Ananda, who has here consented to or willed his involution in the nescience for a certain round of soul experience, impossible otherwise, and presides secretly over its evolution. That's us above, what he describes elsewhere as the Jivatman, at one with Satchitananda, an aspect of the supramental consciousness, but in that supreme ether. As the soul of personality, he is himself part of that long development of the soul experience in the forms of nature. His own evolution must follow the laws and the lines of the universal evolution. As a spirit, he is one with the transcendence, which is immanent in the world and comprehensive of it. As a soul, he is at once one with and part of the universality of Satchitananda, self-expressed in the world. His self-expression must go through the stages of the cosmic expression. His soul experience follow the revolutions of the wheel of Brahman in the universe. So, the high self above, supporting the evolving soul here. One and the same reality, one in eternity, the other immortal, moving through time. More as we read next, and if you're following in the CWSA version of The Life Divine, we are on page 789. Perhaps there's a profound mystic significance in that. This is such a beautiful passage. Thanks for being with me as we read it. I've looked for something that may speak to the disclosure of the supreme and the universal in the awakening individual from Savitri. And here's a passage which I think you'll enjoy hearing. This is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 5, the Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. In a divine retreat from mortal thought, in a prodigious gesture of soul sight, his being towered into pathless heights, naked of its vesture of humanity. As thus it rose, to meet him bare and pure, a strong descent leaped down, a might, a flame, a beauty half visible with deathless eyes, a violent ecstasy, a sweetness dire, enveloped him with its stupendous limbs and penetrated nerve and heart and brain that thrilled and fainted with the epiphany. His nature shuddered in the unknown's grasp. In a moment shorter than death, longer than time, by a power more ruthless than love, happier than heaven, taken sovereignly into eternal arms, hailed and coerced by a stark absolute bliss, in a whirlwind circuit of delight and force, hurried into unimaginable depths, upborne into immeasurable heights, it was torn out from its mortality and underwent a new and bornless change. An omnipresent pardon me. An omniscient knowing without sight or thought, an indecipherable omnipotence, a mystic form that could contain the worlds, yet make one human breast its passionate shrine, drew him out of his seeking loneliness into the magnitudes of God's embrace. As when a timeless eye annuls the hours, abolishing the agent and the act, So now his spirit shone out wide, blank, pure. His wakened mind became an empty slate on which the universal and soul could write. All that represses our fallen consciousness was taken from him like a forgotten load. A fire that seemed the body of a god consumed the limiting figures of the past and made large room for a new self to live. Eternity's contact broke the molds of sense. A greater force than the earthly held his limbs. Huge workings bared his undiscovered sheaths. Strange energies wrought and screamed tremendous hands, unwound the triple cord of mind and freed the heavenly wideness of a Godhead's gaze. As through a dress, the wearer's shape is seen. There reached through forms to the hidden absolute a cosmic feeling and transcendent sight. Increased and heightened were the instruments. Illusion lost her aggrandizing lens. As from her failing hand the measures fell, atomic looked the things that loomed so large. The little ego's ring could join no more. In the enormous spaces of the self, the body now seemed only a wandering shell. His mind, the many-frescoed outer court of an imperishable inhabitant. His spirit breathed a superhuman air. The imprisoned deity rent its magic fence. So, thank you for being with us all. Namaste. Jai Ma.